from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, for late tuner inners, just a little bit of background. First of all, thanks to everybody who showed up at the House of Blues in Hollywood and at Book Soup in Hollywood. That won't happen again. Not because it wasn't great, just because it was in Hollywood. Things like that only happen in Hollywood. But thank you all. And, you know, you don't have to be in Hollywood to buy the CD. Songs Pointed and Pointless. It's on sale. The limited number of places where CDs are still on sale. Anyway, just a bit of background. I didn't start out as a person who looked askance at Pakistan. I did study Pakistan in school, college, for those of you taking notes, like I was back then. And then years and years later, I did have the opportunity, against my better judgment, I might say, because you know, you may know my feeling that it's a bad idea for satirists to get to know political leaders personally, because by their profession, they're supposed to be charming and charismatic. So, you know. But I did have the occasion to have a dinner with the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, who was, in fact, charming and charismatic and smart. Now, you know, we've learned over the last 6 years, it's harder to fake that. And I have no idea whether she's guilty or was guilty of any of the charges of corruption that were laid against her by her successor, the general who seized power, General Musharraf. But it did bring Pakistan back to my attention. So it was at the point of 9/11 when the President of the United States said we're attacking Iraq because it fulfilled the three conditions for us to attack. A, it had weapons of mass destruction. B, it had attacked its neighbors. And C, it gave safe haven to terrorists. And the question arose in my mind shortly after that. Well, there's some doubt about whether Iraq fits all three of those qualifications, but there's no doubt that Pakistan fits all three. And so it is we've now come to this moment. Dateline Washington. The United States, this is from the Times of India, which of course has its own dog in the fight. The United States is having anxiety attacks, says the Times of India, over the prospect of loose nukes in Pakistan. An ongoing security review of the evolving situation in Pakistan by the U.S. reveals that Washington has full knowledge about the location of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, but it is not certain who might start controlling them if there is a shift in power. CNN reported on Friday that the beleaguered President General Musharraf, quote, controls the loyalty of the commanders and senior officials in charge of the nuclear program, but those loyalties could shift at any point, unquote. That's reassuring. Musharraf's control over the military remains limited to certain top commanders and units, raising worries about whether he can maintain control over the long term, according to CNN. The deep U.S. concern is in sharp contrast to the almost karmic indifference to the prospect of loose pack nukes in India. There's been little or no debate about the matter in India. India may have more to worry about than the U.S. in the event of Pakistan's nuclear weapons falling into wrong hands. Washington and New York are beyond the direct range of Pakistani nukes. Almost every Indian city is within their reach. Yet it is U.S. analysts who are sweating bricks, says the Times of India. Some experts have already begun analyzing the fallout of a Pakistani regime collapse in terms of not just ready-to-use nukes, but from the dispersal of key staff, critical technologies, technical data, components, etc., to other maverick groups or nations. Washington has long sought to get a fix on Pakistan's crown jewels. Well, That would have been possible had we been able to question the father of the Pakistan nuclear bomb, AQ Khan, when he was arrested for proliferating nuclear weapons and know-how to Libya, Iran. There's one other. Forget who. Hey, when he's proliferating, who's counting? But the Pakistani government would never let the United States question him. He's been held in house arrest, under house arrest, and protected from questioning by curious minds in the United States. Lieutenant General, back to the Times of India, Lieutenant General Khalid Kidwai, head of the Pakistan Strategic Plans Division, who's in charge of the operational security of Pakistani nukes, has been a frequent visitor to the U.S. in an effort to assure Washington of the country's total custodial control of the weapons. Pakistan, of course, the country the CIA recently fingered as the place where Osama bin Laden has established safe haven. Why wouldn't that make you want to ask some questions about our ally, Pakistan? Hello, welcome to the show.
I never thought it would happen with me and the girl from Clapham. I don't know what it comes. That night I had forgotten, but she dealt out the rations with some other passions. I said, you are a lady. Perhaps she said, I may be. We moved into a basement with thoughts of our engagement. We stayed in by the telly, although the room was smelly. We spent our time just kissing, the railway arms were missing. This lover got us hooked up, and all our time it took up. I got a job with Stanley, he said I'd come in handy, and started me on Monday, so I had a bath on Sunday. I worked 11 hours, bought the girl some flowers. She said she'd seen a doctor, and nothing now could stop her. I worked out through the winter, the weather bright and bitter. I put away a tenner, each week to make it better. And when the time was ready, we had to sell the telly. By the fire, a little pix inside her. This morning at 4:50, I took a ride with Nippy down to an elevator. But 30 minutes later, she gave birth to a daughter within a year of walking. She looked just like a mother, but there could be another. And now she's 2 years older, her mother's with a soldier. She left me when I dreamed. Something missing. I beg for some forgiveness, but begging's not my business. And she won't write a letter, though I always tell her. And so it's my assumption I'm really up the junction.
You're welcome. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. From the trade magazine of public broadcasting, Current, not to be confused with Al Gore's TV channel of the same name, which I still can't get. This story... Headline, as if these guys needed more animation. What? I'll read it for you. That's why it's called I'll Read the Trades for You. You see what I'm saying? Explain the premise again. PBS's first primetime cartoon series is also probably the first regular show anywhere based on fictional private lives of public radio stars. The first run of half hours starring the sibling hosts of NPR's Car Talk will debut in summer 2008. PBS announced at the Summer TV Critics Press Tour. A contest to come up with a name for the TV show will be announced on the radio show. The setup casts Tom and Ray Magliazzi as slackers with disgruntled car repair customers while giving safe driving advice for an underwriter, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. The show does have a cast of fictional characters, including a former Harvard professor named Krusty. There's a lawsuit. But wait a minute. Where's the laugh track? It's a TV show. Cue the laugh track. Co-executive producer Howard K. Grossman proposed the project to PBS some 3 years ago. Grossman's TV credits include Billy Joel, Live from Long Island. The other EP was Robert Harris, president of Universal Television, where he oversaw the production of Murder, She Wrote and Miami Vice. Bill Croyer, executive producer of animation, directed the animated movie Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest. Doug Berman, the radio show's longtime executive producer, and Doug Mayer, head writer. They have writers? No wonder there's laughter. Are the writers. Karen Johnson, producer of animation, is founder and CEO of AHA Studios. Alyssa Myers, a veteran casting director now based in New York, found the actors for characters other than the Magliazzis. I think you're going to need a bigger audience, though, guys. It's TV. There you go. Because we know what the target audience is. It's Magliazzis. Animated Tom and Ray, ladies and gentlemen. What public broadcasting is meant to bring you. What we realize when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And other news of television, ladies and gentlemen. Educational DVDs may hinder rather than help a young child's learning. Infants who watch DVDs such as Brainy Baby know fewer words than those who do not watch such programs, reports New Scientist magazine. In recent years, the popularity of such infant programs has soared, particularly in the United States. Parents hope the programs, which typically consist of brief dialogue and picture sequences, will boost the learning ability of children as young as 8 months old. Even though the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that youngsters not watch TV until they're two. To find out what effect these programs have, a researcher at the University of Washington, Seattle, with his colleagues, contacted about 500 families with a child born in the previous 16 months. Telephone interviews had the parents hear a list of about 90 words, such as truck and cookie, and indicated which their 8 to 16-month-old children understood. They also gave other details, such as how much they read to their children and the amount of type of television their youngsters watched. The results contradict claims that baby DVDs help toddlers to communicate with their parents. After controlling for other factors such as parents' educational status and the number of children per household, the analysis revealed that for every hour per day spent watching baby DVDs, toddlers understood an average of 6 to 8 words fewer than those who did not view them. On average, the children recognized about 25 words. The number varied according to age. Quote, there are only a fixed number of hours that babies are awake and alert, says Andrew Meltzoff, a co-author of the study. He says babies are not getting the same linguistic experience that they would from interacting with adults if that alert time is spent watching DVDs. So, now we're going to prevent babies from being made dumber by television, which only leaves the rest of us. Speaking of which, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin apparently watches a lot of baby DVDs. He says he worries that murders in New Orleans make it seem dangerous. But news of such crimes, quote, keeps the New Orleans brand out there, unquote. Take those DVDs away from him, please. This is In a city where the tourism industry is the lifeblood of the fragile economy, the violence threatens to derail efforts to bring visitors as well as former residents back. Nagin, at a bricklaying ceremony this week, told reporters it's a, quote, two-edged sword, unquote. It's not good for us, but it also keeps the New Orleans brand out there, and it keeps people thinking about our needs and what we need to bring this community back, he said. Sure, it hurts, he continued, but we have to keep working every day to make the city better. Anti-violence activist Batty Landis called Nagin's remarks, quote, stunningly insensitive. But Mayor Nagin is not the only person or entity obsessed with brand identity in the new century, as we'll learn on News from Outside the Bubble moments from now here on Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time for news from outside the bubble. Dateline Hohhot, China. Inner Mongolia boasts more than 20 nationally known brands of food, cashmere, and other products. Supported by the leading brands, the region has topped China's provincial areas in economic growth for the past 5 years. Inner Mongolia set an example for the country, and their experience should be studied and disseminated for developing domestic brands. says the vice chairwoman of the People's National Congress. She says the national economy has been developing steadily for many years, but China is still only a, quote, manufacturing giant, not a, quote, brand power. To compete internationally, the country needs its own brands. It's time to become a brand power. This is from Asia Times, by the way. As a manufacturing giant, China's made its presence felt in every corner of the global market with, quote, made in China labels, which have helped boost its economy. However, the country is increasingly involved in trade disputes with major partners such as Europe and the United States, which complain that the flood of Chinese products damages their own injuries, steals job opportunities, seriously unbalances trade, and, of course, the latest issue, the product quality crisis spreading from the U.S. to other countries. Suddenly, those countries are raising substandard or unsafe complaints since the beginning of the year. Though unconvincing, according to Chinese officials, those complaints had spurred the Chinese government to consider ways to change its growth pattern, and the development of home brands is one of its latest strategies, she says. Yeah, it's easier than making sure the fish isn't contaminated. Ai Feng, vice president of the China Quality Association and an expert in trademarks and brands, how'd that happen? Says quality is at the heart of brands, and fostering brands will undoubtedly help boost product quality. Isn't that backwards? No! China is seeking to turn from price competition to quality competition, he says. Commerce Minister Bo Jilai said the country is at the very early stage of brand development. Fewer than 20% of exporters have their own brands, and self-owned brands account for no more than 10% of total exports. The result is the Chinese enterprises make only humble profits by manufacturing for foreign brands. A much talked about story in China is that to buy a single Airbus 380, China had to export 800 million shirts. On the other hand, you can't fly shirts. To maintain the strong momentum of economic growth, made in China must become created in China, says Li Guangzhu, an expert on brand development. They got all these experts on brands in China. How did that happen? The future belongs to brands, especially global brands, he says. Vice Minister of Commerce Zhang Zhengwei says the government has stepped up efforts to promote brand strategy, mainly involving the improvement of the brand appraisal system, whatever that is, protection of intellectual property, that's a new one for China, and a brand promotion system. So far, 30 provincial regions have established brand promotion institutions, and brand development has been written into their economic development plans, says one of the government officials. So we'll look for those Chinese brands. They'll be coming soon. And also, news from outside the bubble, Britain's multimillion-dollar counter-narcotics operation in Afghanistan has been exposed as a failure, according to the Rupert Murdoch-owned Times of London. Afghanistan is poised to report a record poppy crop again this year. Or a crappy pop. Britain is leading international efforts against opium production in Afghanistan. The Foreign Office Minister responsible for the region, Lord Malik Brown, says he's extremely disappointed with the latest results. Afghanistan broke its own record for poppy production last year when 165,000 hectares were cultivated. Hectares. Unit of measure we don't have in this country. Quote, Afghanistan is facing another year of very high poppy cultivation driven by continued high figures in the south and, to a lesser extent, the east, says Malik Brown. British forces are concentrated in the south, Helmand Province. The province is home to 6,000 British troops engaged in fighting the Taliban, but they are barred by NATO's rules of engagement from taking any direct action against poppy cultivation, even though 90% of the heroin sold on British streets comes from Afghanistan. Well, get it up on the sidewalk where it belongs. Despite the latest setback, British officials insisted that new efforts would be made to tackle the cultivation and trade by boosting the Afghan government's own counter-narcotics operations. Yes, that should work. Because Dateline Bogota. Aerial spraying of an herbicide by the Colombian government on the border of Colombia and Ecuador has caused a high degree of DNA damage in local Ecuadorian people, according to a new study. The research being published in the next issue of Genetics and Molecular Biology. This is your brain on the war on drugs. The scientists from a university in Ecuador analyzed blood samples from 24 Ecuadorians living within 3 kilometers of the border of the two countries. Aerial spraying of a herbicide sold under the name Roundup by Monsanto took place on the Colombian side of the border between late 2000 and early 2001. I bet we helped pay for that. The Colombian government sprays illegal coca plantations as part of the war on drugs. According to the paper, the application rate of the herbicide was 20 times the maximum recommended for the product. Half the individuals in the group received spraying directly over their houses, and the blood samples were taken within 2 months. Blood samples were taken also from 21 Ecuadorian individuals living away from the border, where aerial spraying did not take place. In addition to the expected symptoms, vomiting and diarrhea, blurred vision and difficulty in breathing. Hey, what's your problem? The researchers found a significantly higher degree of DNA damage, 600 to 800% higher in the people living near the border. The researchers ruled out tobacco, alcohol, non-prescription drugs, and asbestos as causing the damage. None of the individuals used or had been exposed to other herbicides or pesticides when the samples were taken. And, on a related subject, Thailand's post-coup government has reopened an investigation into ousted Premier Thaksin Shinawatra's war on drugs in which more than 2,500 people were killed, according to a senior justice ministry official. The probe into a 2-year crackdown, which was popular among rural voters but outraged human rights groups, will be led by a small independent body, chaired by the former attorney general. Thousands of lives have been tossed away like fish or vegetables, therefore we must find the person responsible, says a justice ministry official. We must have an answer for society how those 2,500 people died. The committee will probe deaths that Thailand's government said were largely the result of drug dealers killing each other, but which human rights groups said were extrajudicial police killings. Thaksin, now living in exile in London, launched a war on drugs in 2003, won a second landslide election victory 2 years later, largely on the back of support of the countryside. At the time, Thailand, which was once a major supplier of heroin, was awash with meth made across the border in Burma. The war on drugs cut supply and pushed up prices for a while, but business has now returned to normal. And finally, news from outside the bubble. You know that Britain is talking about withdrawing its troops from Basra in Iraq, the southern region of Iraq. Well, guess who's going to replace those troops? From the Sunday Telegraph, America is preparing to pour thousands of extra troops into southern Iraq amid fears that the British government is committed to withdrawing troops from the region early next year. The White House and the Pentagon are understood to have drawn up detailed plans to secure the vital umbilical cord link road between Baghdad and Kuwait when the British depart. Washington is also concerned that a British pullout will leave the border with Iran undefended, as well as undermining U.S. operations at a time when political pressure is mounting for an American withdrawal. Tensions are understood to have deepened between London and Washington after new Prime Minister Gordon Brown's recent visit to the U.S. Military chiefs in the U.S. have been, quote, dismayed, unquote, by the threat of a unilateral pullout from southern Iraq by British forces. The Sunday Telegraph has also learned that neither the British nor the Americans have a plan B. That's the rarest plan in the American arsenal, apparently, given our history in Iraq. We don't do plan B for sending troops back into Iraq if the country descends into chaos when the coalition finally withdraws. One senior source says, whether or not we go back in if it all goes horribly wrong is the strategic question to which neither the U.S. nor the British government has an answer. British sources admit there is a firm consensus among British military chiefs that maintaining a presence in Iraq after the control of Basra passes to the Iraqis this November is, quote, pointless. One senior officer who has served in Iraq says, quote, in terms of intervention operations, the military can never deliver success if the policy is wrong. And in terms of Iraq, the policy of intervention was wholly wrong from start to finish, unquote. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. It's nicer to live in the bubble, isn't it? Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And this week sees the 30th anniversary of the passing of Elvis Presley. There's going to be a lot of warm and sentimental tributes to the late lamented king of rock and roll. Not among them, the video for this song premiering this Tuesday at mydamnchannel.com. Watch with care.
I'm all backed up, oh, I'm all backed up, oh, I'm all backed up. I can eat my fill, but where's the thrill? 'Cause I'm all backed up. Well, my doctor said he didn't know what to do. He gave me some pills and told me not to sue. Hey, my cup. Well, look at me. I'm all backed up. Oh, oh, oh. I'm all backed up. Oh, 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 oh. I'm all backed up. I can eat my fill, but where's the thrill? 'Cause I'm all backed up. Back me up, boy. The coffee. Well, the road and rude a man came and brought his snake. He said, this may hurt, yeah, this might ache. 2 hours later, snake says, I give up. Says he may be the king, but he's all backed up. Oh, oh. He's all backed up, oh, 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 oh. He's all backed up. He can eat his fill, but where's the thrill? 'Cause he's all backed up. Yeah, I can eat my fill, but I can't get a thrill, 'cause I'm all backed up. Oh, 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 oh. All backed up, oh, oh.
On a related subject, ladies and gentlemen, Lisa Nowak, remember her? The astronaut who is alleged, the former astronaut who is alleged to have driven from Florida to Texas wearing a diaper to limit the number of rest stops she had to make along the way because she was in such a hurry to confront her romantic rival in a NASA love triangle, has petitioned the court to have the bracelet, the ankle bracelet, removed. Because she says it's not lightweight. It's not easy to wear. Its battery was running out when she was driving on the freeway, and you have only about a minute or two to replace the battery before it emits a loud, alarming siren, and she can't get on a commercial airliner because apparently she gets stopped at the security stop when she's wearing the ankle bracelet. So now she wants to fly as opposed to driving with a diaper on. Allegedly. Meanwhile, it may be catching on.
Hey, dude, where are you rushing off to?
Oh, gotta get this very important package across town, pronto. No stops.
Huh. Hope you're wearing your scampers.
When you've got no time to stop, you can still go.
Breaker, breaker, good buddy. Meet you at the Mesa Junction truck stop.
Oh, that's a nugatory. We're driving straight on through.
You must be packing your scampers.
Scampers aren't for everyone, but if you're on a tight schedule, if you've got to be somewhere yesterday, scampers can carry your load.
Great speech, Senator. Do you need a break?
No, I'll meet my donors right now. Glad I cast my vote for scampers.
Astronaut-proofed scampers. Peace of mind for your hurry-up lifestyle. And you don't even need to ask your doctor. Scampers. When you can't stop, you can go.
News of the new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. The Brits, of course, are pulling out of southern Iraq. And as they do so, Shiite militias there, according to the Washington Post, have escalated a violent battle against each other for political supremacy and control over oil resources. Who would have thunk that? This is deepening concerns among some U.S. officials that elements of Iraq's Shiite-dominated national government will turn on one another once U.S. troops begin to draw down. So let's just stay. What do you think? Three major Shiite political groups are locked in a bloody conflict that has left the city of Basra in the hands of militias and criminal gangs whose control extends to municipal offices and neighborhood streets. The city is plagued by, quote, the systematic misuse of official institutions, political assassinations, tribal vendettas, neighborhood vigilantism, and enforcement of social mores, together with the rise of criminal mafias that increasingly intermingle with political actors. This from the International Crisis Group. Sounds like good progress to me. It's hard to paint Basra as a success story, says a senior U.S. official in Baghdad with long experience in the southern part of the country. Instead, it has become a model with that U.S. officials with experience in the region are concerned will be replicated throughout the Iraqi Shiite homeland, from Baghdad to the Persian Gulf. A recent series of war games commissioned by the Pentagon warns of civil war among Shiites after a reduction in U.S. forces. That's not even counting the Sunnis. In the homogeneous south, where there are virtually no U.S. troops or al-Qaeda fighters, few Sunnis, and by most accounts limited influence by Iran, Shiite militias fight one another as well as British troops. A British strategy launched last fall to reclaim Basra neighborhoods from violent partisans, similar to the current U.S. surge strategy in Baghdad, brought no lasting success. Says a senior U.S. intelligence official, quote, the British have basically been defeated in the South. Sounds like a defeatocrat to me. They're abandoning their former headquarters at Basra Palace, where a recent official visitor from London described them as, quote, surrounded like cowboys and Indians by militia fighters. I guess they mean like cowboys surrounded by Indians. The Brits don't know our history that well, I guess. An airport base outside the city, where a regional U.S. embassy office and Britain's remaining 5,500 troops are barricaded behind building-high sandbags. Will you take a look at those sandbags? They're as high as a building. Has been attacked with mortars or rockets nearly 600 times over the past 4 months. The administration is been reluctant to publicly criticize the British withdrawal. But the United States, according to a British defense expert, quote, has been very concerned for some time now about the lawless situation in Basra. The expert says this has been expressed at the highest levels by the U.S. government to British authorities. So a model, if not a model lady, for the future of Iraq. Can we say Shiites on the radio yet? And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Starting out with an apology from the host of this broadcast for the fact that the pledge drive version of this broadcast, truncated to make room for begging, was on the internet last week. The responsible parties have not had nearly enough severe things happen to them. Former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani apologized this week for comparing his own exposure to toxic materials at the World Trade Center site to that of first responders during a campaign stop in Ohio. In a radio interview, Giuliani says he misspoke when he said he was at the site, quote, as often, if not more, than most of the workers. That comment upset some fire and police officials, saying their members gave their health for the recovery effort. Speaking with radio host Mark Gallagher, whose show is not heard in your area, Giuliani said he was just trying to show empathy for the first responders when he made the comments. Strange kind of empathy. I was there more than you. See how much empathy I have? Dateline Los Angeles, a Mexican tourism official issued an apology for the jeers aimed at Miss USA in May during the International Beauty Contest in Mexico City. Rachel Smith was booed by some of the audience after she slipped and fell during the evening gown competition. Her fall and the audience reaction briefly attracted international attention. Gabriel Zecali, chief of staff for Mexico's tourism department, wrote in a letter that he regretted the unfortunate events of the pageant. Quote, we understand the concern of the people of the United States about the incorrect behavior of a small group that attended the event. We apologize for the inconvenience and be sure that Miss Rachel Smith will always be welcome in Mexico. I don't know if that's reassurance or a threat. Dateline Raleigh, North Carolina, Don Beeson, the lobbyist who gave former North Carolina House Speaker Jim Black a $500,000 loan, has resigned from the State Lobbyist Association. Beeson sent a resignation letter to the group, apologizing for his, quote, serious error in judgment. Black was sentenced to more than 5 years in federal prison, identified Beeson in a state sentencing hearing as the lobbyist who lent him $500,000. In June, Black was vague about how Beeson came to lend him the money. There was no written agreement, and the loan commanded no interest. That's a bribe-top loan, that is. Alaska Airlines' on-time performance fell again in June, dropping to 70%. That's down from 76% in May, which is down from 79% in April. Do you detect a trend? Alaska Airlines officials apologized for the poor on-time performance. Quote, we went into summer thinking we were ready. Despite our best efforts, we didn't get far enough ahead of the pressures we knew would happen, and we've fallen short. For that, we apologize to our employees and our customers, says Glenn Johnson, executive vice president. Now all we have to do is apologize for the rest of the service, and we'll be even. Dateline Los Angeles, AT&T, says a company it hired to handle the cybercast of a live concert by Pearl Jam erroneously omitted lyrics criticizing U.S. President Bush that were in a song performed by the band. Those lyrics in no way, shape, or form should have been edited, says AT&T spokesperson Michael Coe. Then, a day later, AT&T revealed that it had tinkered with other performers' webcasts as well. An AT&T spokeswoman said, it's not our intent to edit political comments and webcasts. Unfortunately, it has happened in the past on a handful of cases. We have taken steps to assure that it won't happen again. That's from spokesperson Tiffany Nels. Did not specify what the steps were, nor did it mention what performers were involved. Another airline is apologizing, and well should it. Northwest Airlines said it is almost certain that an object found in the backyard of a Wisconsin home fell off one of its planes earlier in the week. The 2-foot-long piece of metal was found Wednesday just a few yards from the home of Russ and Judy St. Clair. It's a missing part, says Northwest, that fell from Flight 1449 inbound from Detroit early Wednesday morning. Russ Ulmer, a longtime pilot and now CEO of aviation experts, said that objects fall from flying aircraft all the time. He said those are usually smaller pieces, comparing them to nuts and bolts that might fall from cars. Like, that's reassuring. Oh, it's just nuts and bolts falling from your car. Nothing worse than that. Quote, some of the airlines these days, because of the financial problems, they're outsourcing their maintenance, and this particular aircraft, it's pretty old. Ulmer agrees with Northwest Airlines officials that the incident was not a flight safety issue. But he said he hopes the FAA tightens its rules on maintenance procedures. A Northwest representative visited the home of the St. Clair's, checked for damage, and personally apologized for the incident. No apology to the passengers on the aircraft from which the part fell. Roseanne Barr has fired an intern who posted a drunken-sounding ramble purporting to be from the veteran comedian. on her MySpace homepage. Barr said in a statement on her website, RoseanneWorld.com, that the intern responsible for the bogus post had been fired. The post said, among other things, quote, "I would rather just smell like pee like old ladies are meant to do. Aloha." The postings were swiftly removed. Barr apologized for the incident. One of the interns who was administering my MySpace page, I guess it should be our space, has been fired, she wrote. "I apologize for the offensive blogging that went on there last night. I write only at RoseanneWorld.com. I apologize to all on MySpace who received the offensive bulletins. The matter has been handled," unquote. Don't tell L. Ron. KPBS San Diego, public broadcasting NPR station down there, has a manager who was getting a fair amount of abuse for canceling a couple of local programs. He wrote in a blog at the station's website, quote, "I don't know where people get the odd idea that we should survey members on every management decision we make. Never has it been a collective or even a participatory democracy," he's referring to the radio station. "I make decisions the same way every general manager before me did. And I'm tired of accused of being arrogant when I do my job and refuse to apologize for it." That didn't last long. Within a day or two, he said this. "First of all, I again apologize for my original post. I'd come to the end of a very long and difficult week, and it was certainly inappropriately defensive and harsh, so I hope you accept my apologies. I think some really great points have been made by recent commenters. Again, thanks for all your participation, and I once again apologize for being unpleasant last week." Didn't apologize for canceling the show a couple years ago. And finally, London Dateline, pop singer Justin Timberlake has apologized to his Australian fans for the misbehavior he and his then-girlfriend Cameron Diaz showed during his appearances there in 2004 and promised that he will play nice with the locals when he performs in Australia on October 31st. During the previous tour, Timberlake and Diaz flipped their middle fingers and scowled anytime they spied a camera. Reporters who attended his only Australian press conference were bullied and warned not to ask any controversial questions. What controversial questions could you ask Justin Timberlake? Justin, about Basra. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
From the BBC, this is I Put It To You. I'm Edward Purdom. And tonight, the controversy over Jack Straw's call for Muslim women to put down the veil has escalated further. After the defense by several Muslim women that they wear the veil for personal, not strictly religious reasons, a native Briton has stepped forward to seek their support in his own battle for sartorial freedom. Tonight, I'm putting it to screaming Lord Such Jr., the illegitimate son of the late eccentric perennial political gadfly. Lord Such Jr., welcome to I Put It To You.
Thank you, Edward.
And I do put it to you, sir, that your so-called crusade for freedom to dress as you please in public has nothing in common with the desire of these Muslim women to veil 99% of their faces and bodies.
Well, you see, that's where you and I must agree to part company, assuming, of course, that we ever were in company previously, which I tend to doubt. But, Edward, I must insist on the commonality of my position with that of the Muslim women. They said on your very network that they wear the veil to feel more confident, less vulnerable to men viewing them as a sex object.
Yes, and as this file footage clearly shows, sir, your chosen form of public dress is to go about major streets in London clad only in a nappy.
What the Americans call a diaper, yes, sir?
Well, I put it to you, sir, that this is a travesty of their position.
Well, surely not, Edward. Once the question is what makes one feel more confident, we're really in an area of maximum personal discretion. If I say to you that strolling down Regent Street in what I must insist is a perfectly clean and fine-looking nappy is what imbues in me that same plenitude of confidence, who are you, sir, to say to me, "Hold, sir, you must put on some trousers and a jumper"?
Well, yes, but don't you think community cohesion is challenged by your decision to
stride along the avenues of commerce in a state of substantial undress?
Well, not unless my state of undress is construed to be a discouragement to others to buy more clothing. Is that where we've come to, Edward? No, sir. If a community is to embrace all the strands of diversity, then those of us who believe that we've never been better dressed than when we were first dressed need to be embraced for who we really are.
Even if the embrace is of necessity at arm's length.
Oh, certainly.
But I do put it to you, sir, that these women, many of whom insist that their choice has not been coerced either by religious dictate or by their male relatives, they say they feel freed from the constraints of having to follow a certain socially approved standard of attractiveness, the so-called sex object argument.
Well, I understand completely, Edward, and we are so on the same wavelength, so to speak, that I'm at a loss to understand what it is that you keep putting to me.
Well, are you seriously suggesting that wearing the normal adult male clothing in modern England subjects you to unwanted attention as a sex object? I put it to you that surely you're not...
No, sir, quite the contrary. The normal adult male clothing, as you call it, deprives me of nearly all the attention I desire as a sex object. Surely you don't suggest that the need for such attention is any less deserving of societal respect than the need for less such attention? If so, I would put it to you, sir, that you were being something of the fool.
But what are you to say, Lord Such Junior, to the argument that your position opens the door, as it were, to full physical nudity?
Ah, but you see, Edward, I'm exposing no socially disturbing part of my body in my chosen form of attire. Everything naughty is nicely wrapped up in white cotton for private viewing at another time. Well, I just seek the personal identity, even at my rather advanced age, of a sexually attractive being, and I would suggest that to deprive me of that right to express and experience my identity in the public square is the very cause upon which I base my bond with the Muslim women of Britain.
Well, now you're not suggesting, are you, that this choice in your case has any religious motivation whatsoever?
Well, I'm sure I could find something in the Bible about humbleness of raiment and such, but just as my Muslim sisters insist on their right to a personally fulfilling physical identity, in their case one of total concealment, I insist on that same right, sir, as expressed in near total revealment.
Revealment.
Well, you said I'm eccentric. Indeed.
But as a spokesman for the Borough Council have made clear, they do find it seriously disturbing to the public sense of cohesion and contentment for you to be allowed to wander down the footpath looking something like a superannuated toddler. I put it to you, does the community have no right to maintain a sense of public decorum?
Well, Edward, I must insist that this is not an issue of decorum or propriety. I think everyone who has encountered me, once they've recovered from the initial shock and sexual arousal, will tell you that my conduct, my demeanour, has been above reproach. And I'll let you in on a little secret, Edward. This isn't the way I go about my business inside my flat.
Are you putting it to me that, just as the Muslim women eschew the veil at home, that you eschew the diaper?
Oh, certainly, Edward. Were you to be fortunate enough to be invited to my rooms, you might most certainly see me caparisoned in a fine three-piece suit to watch the telly or microwave my dins, so I shan't be lectured about decorum, sir.
Well, in closing, let me just touch on the most delicate possible way on the obvious question here. When you're out and about in your chosen state of dress, do you perhaps find yourself using the nappy or diaper for the purpose for which it was originally intended? That would, I put it to you, pose an aesthetic, if not a more serious issue.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Edward. No, of course. I'm a big boy. I'm a loo user from way back. Let me emphasize again, the choice of the nappy is one of personal identity, not functionality. In fact...
Well, mercifully, before we can encounter any more detail on that subject, we have run out of time for this edition. Our thanks to Screaming Lord Such Junior for letting us put it to him, and please join me again for the next edition of I Put It To You. Goodbye.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
In the darkness of their burrows, puffin chicks. Scottish puffin chicks starve to death while food lies decomposing in front of them. They're not able to swallow the snake pipefish brought back from the North Sea by their parents because it's covered in a hard exoskeleton. This reports the Scotsman. With no fat on their bodies, the puffins soon perish. Shunned even by predators, they're left to decay atop the cliffs of St. Kilda, the latest victims of climate change. The Atlantic puffin is a bird cherished by nature enthusiasts, but the long-term sustainability of the puffin population in one of the most internationally important breeding colonies is uncertain. They are starving to death. The National Trust for Scotland says the adult seabirds are not finding enough food around the archipelago west of the Outer Hebrides. Barely over the half the eggs hatched fledged chicks last year. Meanwhile, coral reefs in the Indo-Pacific are disappearing twice as fast as tropical rainforests, say researchers. They've completed the first comprehensive survey of coral reefs in the region, which is home to 75% of the world's reefs. The corals themselves build their limestone foundation, so if the surface of the reef is not covered with live tissue that is continually secreting it, the reef can erode fairly quickly, explains one of the researchers. Coral cover declined by 1% per year on average between 68 and 2004. Tropical rainforests declined by 0.4% per year. In the early 1980s, about 40% of reefs were covered with live coral. That number has been halved by 2003. Only 2% of Indo-Pacific reefs have the same amount of live coral as they did in the 80s, much less than expected. Dirty brown clouds created by millions of cooking fires in Asia contribute as much to global warming as greenhouse gas emissions and are a major factor in the melting of the Himalayan glaciers, say researchers. Experts had previously thought the clouds acted to deflect sunlight and cool the atmosphere. The findings have serious implications, will give weight to the voices of those seeking to get India and other developing nations to do more to use renewable energy and find alternatives to wood-burning stoves. Or just to send Ed Begley Jr. to India. And finally, mimicking volcanoes has been proposed as a last-ditch solution to climate change. The idea is that pumping sulfur particles into the atmosphere would reproduce the cooling effect of a large volcanic eruption. It now seems it could also cause catastrophic drought, according to New Scientist. A sulfur sunshade could have a deleterious effect on the environment by reducing rainfall. Following the eruption of a volcano in Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, there was a marked decrease in rainfall and runoff. The researchers say this suggests that artificially injecting large amounts of sulfate particles into the atmosphere could have catastrophic effects on the planet's water cycle. But hey, let's screw around some more. What do you say? News of the Warm, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to put the flaming cap on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ 7.415 megahertz, blanketing Berlin via the mighty 104, blanketing North America via Sirius and XM satellite radio, pillowing you with a free download at www.audible.com/theshow, short-seating you with an internet feed whenever you want it, live or archived at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and duveting you with a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like a surfeit of bedroom metaphors, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Email address, playlists available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions that originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.